to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. I don't usually read things to people in a Dharma talk. I'm going to read some things today and comment a little bit. The general topic of this talk is the distinction between reliance upon the head and reliance upon the heart. And by the heart, I mean, of course, the heart with a capital H, the Buddha nature, the eternal. In the beginning of contemplative training, people tend to rely on the head a great deal because they have so little experience of what it is to rely on the heart. And I have to say that this is not universally true. Some people really never lost their ability to rely on their heart. And many of us kept it to some degree, or we never would have found our way to this training. But in general, we start from a position of relying too much on our head and having too externalized a point of view. And we move in the direction of trusting the heart and learning to listen to and follow the heart. Later in training, we can doggedly hang on to the head when we're at the edge of a cliff and need to take a great leap into the unknown. And we are then hanging on to our head for dear life out of that fear of letting go. And of dissolving into something greater. That fear runs so deep, it's the same fear fundamentally as the fear of death. The fact that one has meditated and trained for many years, is no guarantee by any means that one will be able to make that leap into the unknown. Hopefully one will, when the timing is right. And there are no guarantees. If at any point in our spiritual life we doggedly cling to intellectual clarity, really you could say an illusion of intellectual clarity, we then really drive a bung in our connection with deeper spirituality. That which the heart knows, that of which the heart is certain, simply is not susceptible to intellectual analysis. One has to be willing to settle for that blood and bone certainty. And until one has that certainty, one has to be willing to settle for faith. The clinging to intellectual clarity is the real basis of what is called erudition, the obstacle of erudition. Remember Dogen in Rules for Meditation. Cease from erudition, withdraw within and reflect upon yourself. Reverend Master says in Zen is Eternal Life, in the chapter on activity in the heart of Samantabhadra, each ancestor represents a type of person to be found in the world at the present time. In one respect, almost all Westerners come into the same category as a second ancestor, Ananda, in that they love argument and are proud of their erudition. Now, in place of that phrase, they love argument and are proud of their erudition, you could also put in that they cling to intellectual clarity and try to grasp the truth intellectually. As a warning, she goes on to say, as a warning to my fellow Westerners, I would like to point out that it took Ananda almost five times as long as it took anybody else to realize the truth of Zen, simply because of his clinging to books and knowledge. She goes on to say later, all those of my readers who love book learning are heartily advised to take the comments of Kazon to heart when he talks about Ananda and the Denkaroku and warns about erudition, clinging to erudition and intellectual understanding. For they are far truer than they will ever realize this side of Zen understanding. Later on in the chapter in the heart of Manjushri, she quotes in considerable length the great Chinese master Obaku, Siyun Obaku, who says, if students of the way desire to become Buddhas, they need not study anything whatsoever of the Dharma. They should only study how to avoid seeking for or clinging to anything. If nothing is sought, the mind will remain in its unborn state. And if nothing is clung to or known, the mind will not go through the process of destruction. That which is neither born nor destroyed is the Buddha. He goes on to say later on, relinquishment of everything is the Dharma, and he who understands this is a Buddha. But the renunciation of all delusions leaves no Dharma on which to lay hold, no Dharma to grasp, to cling to. If the student of the way wishes to understand the real mystery, he need only put out of his mind attachment to anything whatsoever, especially his own opinions and criticisms. He goes on to say later on, ordinary people look outwards, whilst followers of the way look into their own minds. But the real Dharma is to forget both the external and the internal. The former is easy enough, the latter is very difficult. Now, here's a line that's always stuck in my mind. Men are afraid to forget their own minds, fearing to fall through the void with nothing to which they can cling. They do not know that the void is not really void, but the real realm of the Dharmakaya. This spiritually enlightened nature is without beginning or end, as old as space, neither subject to birth nor destruction, neither existing nor not existing, neither defiled nor pure. It cannot be looked for or sought, comprehended by wisdom or knowledge, explained in words, contacted materially, or reached by meritorious achievement. If a man, when he is about to die, can only regard the five aggregates of his consciousness as void, if he can only awake to this in a flash and remain free from the remaining entanglements of the triple world of past, present, and future, he will indeed be one who leaves the world without the faintest tendency towards rebirth. This is the highest teaching insofar as that highest teaching can be put in words. But in actual fact, in order to be comprehended, it actually has to be experienced through the true, genuine surrender to the eternal. The letting go of the old opinions, old emotions, stubbornness, obstinacy. The letting go. Allow oneself to fall through the void, forgetting one's own mind. And in that place, instead of extermination and extinction, there is the love of the eternal, magnificent beyond any words, beyond the power of any words, beyond the power of our imagination. You cannot conceive of it, you can only experience it. Do not be a sucker for intellectual clarity. The only way you can achieve intellectual clarity, and there's very few people who know this better than me, because I'm good at being intellectually clear. And the way you do it is simply by carving away everything except leaving something simple. And there's nothing wrong with that. It has its uses. But don't think that that is the same as genuine experience of the truth. It is not. It's just something you can do with concepts. The eternal is not something to be conceptually grasped. Conversion is not something that happens in concept. It's something that happens with the actual karma that's distressed and pained and confused. Once one willfully starts down that road of intellectual clarity, what that represents is a decision to put one's faith more in the head than in the heart. That happens when one begins to insist on clarity. And that insistence is deadly to the spiritual life. It's poison. The proper place of the mind of the trainee is in the place in which one has nothing, knows nothing, and craves nothing, clings to nothing. That is the proper place. That's where our true nature resides. Then you leave it up to the eternal to provide you with what you need. The eternal will provide you with what you need for your material care. The eternal will provide you with what you need to know, what you need to understand. Above all, the eternal will provide you with whatever form of love and compassion and whatever form of wisdom and insight is needed to help those lumps of stuck, pained, confused karma, the jangles. We don't have to try to steal it intellectually or by any other means. And when we have an insight, it does not belong to us, and it cannot be held on to. It will have its little life. It will be given for some particular purpose. Then it will be gone again, and you're back to knowing nothing. What is the practical benefit of the knowing nothing? That you're thrown back on asking, turning to the Eternal for help, and meditating to find the answer. When you do that, if the question that you initially had is not a genuine question, that gets exposed because it just falls away. If there's a question that is an expression of a real need, then asking for help and meditating, placing it in the hands of the Eternal, will reveal the answer to the question. Just don't expect it to always be an answer that you will necessarily like. It will be the answer that is the right answer. And that is our responsibility then, to make the right use of that. When that right use is made, then it's gone again. Another leaf blowing away in the wind. Don't fight the wind that blows the leaves away. Let them go. Let them go. To try to make the head do the work of the heart when one is a meditator is to be a deeply divided person. And it may seem like you have to do that for safety's sake. But some insurance policies simply cost too much. You don't have to do it. You can learn a higher way. You don't have to spend your whole religious life crawling. You can actually walk and then run, and then one day you can fly, which means you're then being really carried by the Eternal and you're aware of it. You don't have to settle for second best. In the practice of meditation, we have the most powerful spiritual tool there is. The last thing I'm going to read is from Bendoa, one of Dogen's lectures, called Lecture on Training. He put some questions and answers into this lecture. And here's question number 12. It says, is there any harm in a serious student of Zazen, meditation, doing Shingon mantras or practicing the peaceful illumination training of Tendai at the same time as doing Zazen? Dogen says, when I was in China, the teachers from whom I learned the truth of Buddhism said that they had never heard of any ancestor, either before or now, who had undergone such simultaneous training and then transmitted the truth of the Buddha. One should concentrate solely on one thing if one would understand the truth. That one thing is always the core practice. We are meditators. Our job is to, in the meditation hall, practice this silent turning towards the Eternal, the silent raising of the heart to the Eternal, the silent placing everything on the altar of the Eternal's love and wisdom and mercy and grace. We practice it in this special setting so that we can take this with us and do it day and night in all of our activities so that we can apply it. Apply the same attitude the same stillness, the same concentration, the same effort, the same open heart. Above all, above everything else, the same faith. That's why we do this. We don't need something else than what we have in this magnificent practice. Each school of Buddhism has a teaching and practice that is meant to be complete in itself. And whether any of those others achieve that, I do not know. But I know one thing from my own experience, that what I have in Soto Zen practice, as transmitted by our master, fulfills that to perfection. That has been proved for me in my own experience, not just taken on faith. This works to perfection for those who apply it thoroughly in their lives. It needs nothing else. Those who insist on intellectual clarity run the risk of becoming hungry ghosts who always are floating from one thing to another, always trying to combine things, because nothing ever works for them. But if they weren't insisting in the first place on intellectual clarity, but were content to sit still in their own heart, they wouldn't be needing to look outside themselves. Be content with what you have and apply it thoroughly, night and day. And you will know the magnificence of walking, running, and flying. You will not just be crawling. To all the Buddhas and all